And first up is
Phil Brannigan.
Oh, he's here. Okay.
Somebody's here.
Well, we'll just make you first on the roll call. Jim Patrick, here. And we already did Bill. Bob Berman?
Here.
Jim Hasselman?
Here.
Gary East?
Here.
Braulio Escobar?
I'm here.
John Updike?
Here.
Dustin Capri?
Here.
Greg Sutton?
Oh, Dustin's here.
You can't hear anything?
Yeah, no, you need to be a little... Oh, okay.
You need to be closer. How's that?
Greg Sutton? No? And Andy McGreenery?
Here.
Did I say that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. And she's our newest Citizens Advisory member. So.
Welcome.
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 Thank you.
By the way, it's generally considered the farm team.
I didn't download. Now today all I've got is...
That's the regular...
I got to find the work session. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
We have unfinished business. First up is Newport Housing Study, overview of the constructability assessment.
Yes, thank you. Derek Tokos, Community Development Director. At your last work session, we didn't have this component. And I think it's a pretty important piece of the overall analysis, and it's going to be worked into the study down the road. And I just want to take some time to kind of walk through this with you. It's similar to what was presented to the advisory committee at its last meeting. It's just been cleaned up a little bit on a few of the slides. They're doing a Eco Northwest, our consultant's doing a full write-up on it. That should be done in another week or two. But again, the purpose of the constructability analysis, and this wasn't something we were required to do as part of the housing study, it's something we wanted to do, which was, okay, you know, when we do these housing studies every 7 to 10 years and we're looking at what our land needs are, and we're looking at how much housing we need over a 20-year period, we wanted to take the next step and say, okay, given that need over that 20-year period, which lands are most likely going to produce housing if we could get needed infrastructure to them. So what this does is kind of provide a rough indication of whether residential development on certain key properties is likely to be feasible given the estimated infrastructure costs. So can development, you know, afford to build the needed infrastructure? If it can't, we shouldn't expect that we're going to see housing on that property, even though it's within our urban growth boundary and available for urban levels of residential development. The other piece to this was just refining the assessment of housing capacity to account for infrastructure barriers and challenges. One of the reasons to have this in here too is to, I think, help educate everybody, both at the local level, commission, council, others in the community, but also at the state level, as we have to do these studies and we have to demonstrate to the state that we're taking actions to try to help facilitate the construction of needed housing, that we all understand the role that infrastructure plays in whether or not we actually see housing happen, and if we do, at what price points that housing is going to be available.
A general question, Derek.
Yeah.
Who exactly is the user of this report? Is it you? Is it developers? Is it the general public? Or is there anything usable about this, or is it just a legal requirement?
Well, you know, I believe what this is going to do is this: the user at the end of the day is going to be all of the above to a degree. And I say that because the constructability assessment in many ways is going to inform some of the recommendations and the priorities the city makes in terms of investment of its limited resources to get infrastructure in place where we don't presently have it. I also believe that this constructability assessment will be used to support recommendations for getting more mixed-use housing into our core center areas. Because when you go through this and you see this, what you'll see that jumps out to you, and it's Windhaven aside, and Windhaven's projects are a little bit of an anomaly in that you know, that ties back to a construction company that's held those lands for a very long time, It's part of their retirement portfolio. So they're not really having to acquire land, which is a significant part of your overall cost if you're going to do a project. So it's a little bit different. You take them out of the equation and you look at this. On the periphery, where we have what we call greenfield or undeveloped properties, you're not going to get apartment projects generally to pencil out. The terrain is just not conducive for that, considering, you know, the level of investment and the cost factors associated with trying to do multifamily development. You're just not going to see those properties get developed at high densities. You're going to see lower density, probably single family development on slope, maybe some attached product, but you're not going to see a significant multifamily development where we, along our periphery, because we have such unfavorable terrain for that. And so we still have the need for multifamily, so where's it go? And one of the best areas or candidate areas will likely be our commercial areas in and around US 20 and 101 and a few blocks from that, where if we could get multifamily over first floor commercial retail, create conditions where that's, you know, desirable, well, we have the infrastructure in place to support it. You know, so
you mean like the half of a block where the Head Start school is?
Off US 20, yeah, up in that area would be one area, or 7th and 9th if you're looking at US 101. Or you could even see some of it south of US 22, kind of where you've got some residence and some office, kind of a mix of different stuff there. So,
you know, I'm our this commission's liaison to that meeting,
mm-hmm.
And you know, most of us sat there and listened to the presentation. A lot of the data it seemed came from your office. Didn't seem mm-hmm. like the outside consultants really, you know, had generated the data. It seemed like it came from right here locally. We had a couple of people on the committee who had expertise in pricing, whether they were realtors, mm-hmm. whether it was the lady from the housing authority who does the Section 8 housing. We didn't have any builders on it. It would have been nice to have somebody like Mr. Patrick there to give an assessment. It just seemed like the whole process was, you know, the committee was there just following along, not a lot of input being put in by the local folks, just being led by the folks from the state. That's just my comment. And at the end of the day, it didn't seem as though there was new information that those of us who've been following this issue for a while didn't already have in our heads. You know, lack of workforce housing, lack of housing for doctors, teachers. And then, you know, I guess the one thing that struck out to me was how much property was unavailable to build on because of wetlands or tsunami issues. So that was something new that I learned.
Yeah, I would add, you know, that was the first impression for the committee, and they're going to have opportunity to dig into the write-up that they do as well. Eco Northwest did develop actually a fair amount of data. We did the infrastructure cost side, but they interviewed a number of developers, local developers, and others to come up with the construction cost side of it, labor and materials, what it's going to take to actually construct the product. And we'll see some of that in the more detailed write-up. And I actually do have some of the information I shared with them that I can let you take a look at tonight, which wasn't in that presentation, in terms of some of the meat behind, you know, why the infrastructure numbers landed where they did. But yeah, they interviewed a number of different developers who are building product in Newport, Nye Beach, Wilder area, just scattered around, and multifamily. You know, we had Todd Woodley was interviewed as part of the Windhaven. So anyway, let me just kind of walk through it. We picked, within the urban growth boundary, we picked 9 sub-areas. Some of these are, again, greenfield, larger properties that could potentially generate more units and therefore absorb more infrastructure cost. But then we also wanted to make sure to do some infill sites too. So 7, 8, 9, as we go through, they're more infill areas where you don't have the capacity for huge numbers, but your infrastructure costs aren't going to be quite as high either. Some of the things that really hit you on the greenfield side would be your lift stations, your wastewater and water lift stations, and those areas that you'd have to do new lift stations. I mean, you're getting into the millions on the lift stations, and you're not even looking at the road infrastructure at that point. So we'll cover some more of that. So, you know, and Brawley, you brought this up, and Becky touched on this with the committee, but, you know, what are likely pricing rents for future housing in Newport given market conditions? And the way this analysis was done was to kind of go best case scenario for a developer, that they're going to get best case pricing out of this, either through rental or sale. So they were looking at the higher end numbers, realistic, but on the higher end, because if they can't make it work there, they're not going to make it work at all. So you want to go fairly high on that, but keep it just, you know, within the realm of reason too. So how much could future housing development afford to spend on infrastructure? We kind of tackled this with what they call a residual value, which is you figure out how much, given the value of future development and other development costs, how much is left to pay for the land and infrastructure. And if that gap is too far, then you can expect you're going to have problems with that. If there's not a gap, then maybe, you know, you're in pretty good shape. You know, how many net buildable acres in each subarea? How much housing could be built in each subarea? They vetted different housing types. And you'll see in one of the subareas when we get to that map, you know, one housing type wouldn't pencil out, which was apartments, but another one, say, attached or detached can because of just the kind of return you can get on your investment there. And then what are your infrastructure needs and costs for each subarea? So we'll hit it here real quick. So as part of the analysis, they took a look at you know, apartments, quadplexes, cottage clusters, and this is kind of framed it out. So for apartments, 3 stories, 50 units, you know, this is kind of the program they went. So you need about 72,000 square feet of buildable area. And that's where you start to run into problems with apartments versus single-family detached. And you can see it where, you know, when you go up and look at Windhaven, the amount of earthwork they have to do to create areas where they can actually build the apartment buildings. It's a pretty substantial amount of earthwork. Now, they were construction company-based and had the land, so that wasn't as big of a deal for them as for others. But large wall, retaining walls, and a lot of earthwork. Yep.
How many units ultimately are in that development, all phases?
Well, we don't know what the specific unit number is going to be for the third phase because they haven't gotten to that yet. For the first phase was 66. This phase two is 78. And they were thinking about something in the low 90s for the third phase.
How many of those are?
So that's almost our 20-year requirement being met right there in terms of just raw number of units.
You know, and we talked about that, and the committee's talked about that, you know, in terms of what our need is, setting aside the Portland State estimates, which are goofy. If you go kind of more historic trend line, we're looking at, what, 650 to 700 units in that range is what we need over the next 20 years is what they call for. But again, you know, our experience has been if you can get the units on the market, they're going to get snapped up, be it rental or owner-occupied. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the high degree to which Newport has in commuting for work. You know, we just have, I mean, 5,000 average daily, you know, commuting trips, you know, to the city for employment, you know, coming in from all over the place. You know, from, you know, Siletz and from Toledo and from Walport and from Lincoln City and other areas. You know, a lot of those folks would very much like to live closer. They just can't find anything that meets their needs.
I don't even think that a number of units makes up for our deficit from the last 15, 20 years.
And that's an excellent point, too, Jim. I mean, is this is need moving forward, we have a very, 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 you know, what are we around 2% vacancy rate, maybe just a little bit under that on the rental side. I mean, it's extremely tight, you know, so that pent up demand out there.
Yeah, I mean, this goes a long way to solving some of the previous stuff, doesn't do anything for future. Mm-hmm. The 600, I don't think you should even count it in the 650 you're supposed to need, so.
And remember, when we did the update for OSU student housing in 2014, that assumed OSU would be constructing some student housing, and I believe that they will be doing that, but they still haven't gotten there. Yeah. And they are beginning to ramp up their undergraduate presence out here, which then means that housing has to be absorbed by the community.
Are these pricings, are these in 2022 dollars? Or are these projections for whenever these houses might get built in 5 or 10 years?
I believe it was projected out at least a couple of years, Braulio. Do you remember? We had a conversation about that. I think it was out a couple years.
It was out, about 3 to 4 years.
3 or 4 years
it,
out,
it
I believe.
It seemed to me a little high.
How can you project out 3 or 4 years?
In terms of the rent. I mean, what's your feeling on these
numbers? They have access to data on rental pricing over an extended period of time. So you just extrapolate the curve out for 3 or 4 years to kind of land where that is.
So very roughly. Hmm? They're very rough estimates. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you get, I mean.
Hey, guys.
Dude, Bill?
Hey, Derek. I'm taking a look at slide number 9, small single detached home, and I think looked at a couple of the others. And it has, 1,782 uh-huh. square feet, costs $574,000 on a 4,000 square foot lot, uh-huh. With this 200 by 200. I mean, we're talking pushing $340 a square foot. That sounds excessively high, or am I missing something? I mean, in other parts of the state, you can, $250 gets you a nice house. So,
that unfortunately is kind of where we're trending, in terms of your price per square foot out there for a single family product.
You didn't see me shaking my head when you said that was too high, and I'm like, may not even be high enough.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I don't think it's high enough.
This does not include land cost, or it does?
No.
It does.
No, this does not include your unit price at the end of the day would include the land cost, yes.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I'm curious how many jobs in the town of Newport would support these kinds of prices for a family.
Very few. That's why, when we met 2 weeks, or I guess last month, remember that, slide of 5,000 people coming in and out of Newport?
Mm-hmm.
I took a picture of it when I saw it, because I was like, that's it right there. People can't afford to live here.
Right.
But if you
look at days on market, I mean, this stuff is
I agree. Yeah. Whether they're full-time residents or not is the question.
Right.
And, I mean, there's no doubt that, one, VRDs impact our housing, as does second homes. And I have no idea in America how many second and third homes there are being tied up and they probably are not homes that many people would consider affordable, but it still is part of the housing problem. I mean, it gets a bigger problem for first-time buyers.
Was there a study done or a way to get at that question of full-time residency versus part-time, and to estimate the percentage of housing stock? I know in San Francisco we did that.
They'll extrapolate it, and they have extrapolated off the census data and in terms of the amount of housing that's tied up as seasonal.
Yeah.
Some portion of that would be short-term rentals. Some portion of that's just second homes people have.
Sure.
So it's a combination of the above.
The thing that drove it home for me is when they did the low-income housing out north of town, they gave us their numbers.
Yeah, they had to for that tax.
And their numbers was over $300 a square foot for building apartments where you have economy of scale.
Right.
That you don't have in single-family housing.
Yeah.
It says darn architects.
Who's building a home? So.
They don't even have elevators.
Yeah. Keep in mind, too, that if these numbers were lower, that would make it even more challenging with respect to developer be able to do
you know, projects, given the infrastructure cost side of it.
Well, I'm looking at these numbers, and my wife and I have a small rental unit, 730 square feet next to our home. And we've always been hoping that we were an affordable place. And we rented it up until this year. We were renting it for less than $900 a month. And it was to mostly to researchers at OSU. I'm an educator. Sorry, I prejudice towards educators.
Bias,
you know, I am biased. Yes, and so we're renting it now at $1,100. And now I'm thinking, geez, is my tenant getting a good deal? You know, and I still wouldn't raise it. You know,
but Jim, sometimes it's good to have a good tenant paying slightly less than market rate.
Yeah,
somebody paying market rate. And then you've got
for
the tenant that you have to evict.
Yeah.
You've got damage. You know, a good tenant is golden.
Yeah. I've been fortunate in the 30 years we've done rental properties, but it only takes one bad tenant to teach you a new way.
So anyway, the gist of it here were these were the different housing types or products that they vetted for the different areas, and so in. And then this slide kind of touches on your relative ability to pay for land and infrastructure. So in order what kind of return you can expect. Apartments, the tightest margin, your small single family and your large single family, you know, have a little bit more margin there. That's really what it's showing.
I would say, Derek,
mm-hmm.
That some of these charts And it comes off the target audience for this paper. I think mm-hmm. they missed a lot of. I view myself as a target
mm-hmm.
for this report,
mm-hmm.
and I really found that it wasn't like residual value. Even when it defined it, it wasn't very clear.
Mm-hmm.
Back on page 3 or 4, I couldn't tell. It's the difference between the land costs, the infrastructure costs, the building you put, the improvements. I couldn't exactly tell where you were pulling that residual. I was looking for a mathematical equation.
I think you'll have a little bit more detail in the full write-up. Okay. These are just slides
too,
for the presentation.
I got to this page we're talking, and I said, I wish I really knew the importance of this page, mm-hmm. but I didn't. So
I think at the end of the day, this is really kind of reflects and shows is what we intuitively know. There's a reason why we don't see rapid development along our periphery on lands that are inside our urban growth boundary, because they generally lack infrastructure, and where they lack infrastructure, the cost of getting that infrastructure to that property on top of the cost of constructing the infrastructure internal to the site to support what you want to develop is beyond what a developer can bear and still come out with a product that they can actually get a return on.
One, you can't keep up with it. Like, we have an affordable housing project where in Toledo that's 11 units, mm-hmm. and it was fully funded with a bunch of assistance from the state, the OHCS. And still then, you can't keep up with, I think 2020 was like 7% inflation on residential construction. And then it went up to 13%. And right now they're projecting 2022 is 11.7%.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You can't keep up with it. There's no
mm-hmm.
there's no way to ever get ahead, because you ask for money from the state for, and most of these projects for affordable housing, like the type of units you're talking about, Jim, that are affordable, like truly affordable for people, need subsidies.
What does it cost to build right now per square foot in Toledo?
I have $400 a square foot, something like that. But the reason it's so expensive is because, same thing we were talking about, there's all these sites that are steep, right? There's no good flat land that you can just
absolutely.
Complex.
Yeah. And then you also, and it's not so much the case, it is the case here to some degree, is the equity companies that are getting involved in buying up properties, which just pushes the price. They'll pay the price so they can get the property, and that is another pressure on housing. So,
do you think that's happening locally? I thought that was
No, I think it's happening locally. I'm quite certain it's happening locally.
And speaking of justice, inflation.
Yes, it is.
Rentals are going up 8 to 10% a year.
In cost.
In cost.
In
That's, you know, and it's being limited by, it's being set by the state. That's the max you can raise it.
Right.
And most of them, yes. most of them right. are raising right. the max because, that. Yeah. you know, yeah. if you're way yeah. behind, you're way behind.
Another step in inflation.
Is to have somebody move out and nobody's moving out.
Well, how does that work, Jim? You can only do it once a year. Is that?
Once a year, yeah.
And they limit it to the state limit?
They cap it. Yeah, this that happened a few years ago.
On is that the a COVID thing?
Huh?
Is that a COVID thing or is that before COVID?
No, that was before COVID, I believe. That was in the works for a while. I think it actually got passed during COVID.
Yeah, I think it did. It may have.
It was there. It was being worked on before COVID hit, so.
Yeah, that was either in the 19 or 21 legislative session.
Yeah.
Anyway, so subarea one was up in Agate Beach. And just for context, that's where Surfview Village is. It's right in that area. So this is a property that wraps around it, and it's about 37 and a half acres. And we got what we call Nautical Hills, this big kind of backwards C-shaped piece here. And then we've got another 40 acres down here. The reason why most of this Nautical Hills is white is that white area is about 60 plus acres of a conservation easement that the developer put in place. So that's controlled by a land trust and is not available for development. So only the areas on that one up here and down here are available for development. So with 1A, I mean, you're looking at a collector roadway in terms of major infrastructure needs. And when we priced out our roadway, what we did our sections is we went with our new sections from our transportation system plan. We went reasonably narrow on those where we could. And we priced them out on a kind of a fully loaded price per lineal foot. So it would include your curb gutter, so you got your storm, your water and wastewater, all of that was in there. Because you're assuming you're going to be extending your sewer mains and your water mains as you extend those roads into these properties. So we priced it out in that manner. Bridges, we assumed in these cases 90-foot spans on kind of a prefabricated bridge structures that they can bring them in and panel on the back of trucks, and that's about as big as you can go before you get into a custom bridge kind of design, which frankly the city would do its best to avoid because we don't have staff to maintain bridges. But those prefabricated ones we could handle because you basically they're much simpler and you can swap them out in section if you had to. But those are, you know, $400,000 a piece on a 90-foot span. So and getting more and more expensive. And then, like I said, some of these would need wastewater lift station on 1C, given its grades, and a water pump station there, and then 1D would have a water pump station as well. And these were the different options that were vetted in terms of what kind of units you could potentially get given the buildable acreage you had available. Subarea 2 is what we call Bridgeview Estates. It's 80 acres sitting up above the middle school. Middle school is right here where my cursor is. So you have Harney, and then you'd have to extend Harney up through here, kind of loop it around at Forest Park in that area. Forest Park's kind of right up in here and over here. We had an estimate on Harney we did with the TSP, so we were able to just take that estimate for extending that collector roadway and then proportionally reducing it so that it was just serving this property. So we had pretty good numbers on that. This area B would be actually served through a residential street that terminates down in here. You can't really get to it through here. That's Jeffries Creek drainage through there. That's a very steep draw through there. You wouldn't be able to get between A and B. So we would expect this area B to develop differently than A. Low density residential. Again, you have the whole battery of infrastructure needs on 2A. In addition to the roadway, you'd have your local street network internal, water, wastewater, pump stations, wastewater lift station. Subarea 3 is the area sandwiched between US 20 and Bay Boulevard. We would be putting a new wastewater lift station in at the bottom of the hill on Port property by McLean Point. We have a small urban renewal district that's been put in place to generate funding for that purpose. Hillside low density residential was added through here. Subarea 4, same general location, but north of US 20, much more parcelized up in here, which makes it more challenging in terms of the number of units you'd be able to derive from that.
Quick question, Derek. So going back to 3, you mentioned that for that lift station, there's a financing mechanism for covering some of that cost?
Yes, we have three urban renewal districts, so that's tax increment financing.
Right.
Something, as I understand, California used to do, but can't do anymore or was eliminated. It's part of one of the ways of shoring up the state's budget a few years back.
Kind of, sort of.
We
still do it. We just call it something different.
Come on over.
Bill, you trying to say something?
No.
Okay.
I was talking to the dog.
Oh, okay. but yeah, we have three. We have one in South Beach that's getting close to the end of its life. It'll close to new projects into 2025 and shut down 2027. And then we have a north side one that follows US 20 and 101 and parts of Agate Beach. And that one is the newest one. It was created in 2015. And then McLean Point, also created that same time, picks up just the Port property. It's more of a, well, it's a small district that picked up a bunch of properties that were off the tax rolls, but controlled by private property owner down there for industrial. And they would like to see a wastewater station down there so they can do more robust industrial development. And so by putting their properties onto the tax rolls after we form the district, then 100% of that value flows into the district. But it's a small district. It's only going to generate about $2 million. And that would be for contribution to a wastewater lift station and a gravity sewer line, actually a force main that we're going to need to upsize as part of that project, too.
The reason for the question was I was just trying to get at, so I'm assuming that benefit is backed out of the cost analysis. So if there's a separate TIF source of whatever X million dollars, that isn't calculated under this major infrastructure need, which I assume is a minus to get to residual value.
We didn't factor in how it's going to be paid for.
Okay.
So
costs and didn't look at where that might be coming from.
Right. I mean, okay. So in other words, if when we get to a slide that says there's a big gap, we could bring urban renewal funds to bear to close that gap. Mm. These slides show what a developer can bear, to make this happen, not, our contribution to it.
Okay.
So that it was intended to inform how we might want to make that those contributions.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that's the Aquinnah Heights up there. And like I said, Subarea 4 is more parcelized, which makes it harder to get the kind of yield you would need because you're going to have a harder time doing that with individual parcels as opposed to a larger piece that you have more control over in terms of getting in your development. So, and they summarize here what the infrastructure pieces are. Subarea 5 picks up the balance of Wilder. This is a large planned development we have down in South Beach. We have 68 acres in the city already, but most of it's outside the city. Its benefit is that we got the wastewater and water distribution system in place there, and it's sized to accommodate additional growth. So really what you're looking at here is extension of your roadway network, and then your gravity sewer lines and your water mains, but you're not looking at new pump stations or lift stations. And the city's wastewater treatment plant is, by the way, just close here, just to the south. over here, I think, about over here. Subarea 6 is kind of in the same boat. It's just not part of the planned development. And it doesn't have street access at this point, so you'd have to extend a collector roadway to that. The one nice thing is we had an actual nice clean estimate for what it will take to get a roadway network and water and wastewater in there from a prior potential buyer. And so we're able to provide pretty good numbers on what it would take to get to this one. You know, again, there's a, you know, pretty good margin of error in this stuff. We're not giving them infrastructure dollars like we're basically designing a development on a particular property. We're giving them order of magnitude costs of what we think it's going to take to support a range of different types of housing. And so that, you know, I mean, we don't have the resources to be trying to get down to the, you know, specific widgets on some of this stuff. I mean, we have to keep it a little bit higher level.
Who owns that?
It's called the BGB property, and it's a family that owns that. Subarea 7 was over at, this is over at Herbert and kind of between 3rd and Olive area, in that area. So this is a smaller area. You likely see a more modest number of units, 23, but your costs won't be quite as bad. Subarea 8's over in South Beach off 35th. Same principle. You could get a reasonable number of units down here, more so than the last one, but again, it's infill. And Subarea 9 was also in South Beach, other side of US 101, just north of Camp Gray, where we have a couple of good-sized properties and then a bunch of smaller ones. So this is kind of where the analysis landed in terms of what we can expect. So when you look at the colors on the right, red means you're underwater. Yellow means it's pretty dicey. Green means you should be okay. I mean, that's generally what that's driving at. And you can see it on the charts here too. And so in 1A, for example, if you're gonna try to do multifamily, your infrastructure costs are gonna put you in a position where you're gonna have a problem. If you're up here with your infrastructure costs, based, you know, given your residual value per buildable acre, it doesn't pencil out. These areas here, it probably pencils out for some of these different products. And then here where it's close, you know, these are pretty, you know, hey, if we were able to bring in some city financing on infrastructure, these probably would work. But they may or may not work if it's left just to the developer.
But it doesn't seem as though there's a lot of potential for a private developer without subsidies of some sort.
Certainly in these cases, because your infrastructure costs are quite a bit higher than the residual value of what you'd have. So, you know, per buildable acre, you're just not going to have, you know, it costs too much to serve. You're not going to have any money left over to buy the land. And
the easy areas to develop have already been taken, I think, is mm-hmm. what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so we're left with the more marginal properties.
Mm-hmm. Are any of the monies from the last two big infrastructure bills on the federal level, will any of those dollars shake down for these kinds of projects?
Maybe.
I mean,
some of this may end up getting, part of it has to do with, is it going to be grant or just low interest loans? I mean, yeah. A lot of this stuff will build up low interest loan portfolios of some of these different programs or provide funding to those low interest loan programs. So then the city still has to be cognizant of how much debt load it can take on for
sure.
Wastewater and water. I mean, our utility rates can cover so much.
Yeah.
So, and part of it too depends on where it's targeted. You know, some of that infrastructure is going to be going to large state capital infrastructure like bridges along your highways and things of that nature, which wouldn't help us. So we'll see how it ultimately shakes out. So, you know, and this was pointed out, and just, you know, again, there's a high margin of error here. There are a lot of unknowns. We're not doing this as, you know, hey, we know exactly what's going to happen here and doing a very specific development plan. But it is good for kind of the higher level analysis. Areas 1 and 2 face very high infrastructure costs. I think we just saw them there. Areas 3 and 4 borderline. 5, 6, and 8 have some potential. 7 and 9 have lower infrastructure costs, but we have to keep in mind even lower infrastructure costs on the infill sites could be a barrier because they don't generate as many units. And, you know, these are just 9 sub-areas within our urban growth boundary. We have to, I would assume that some of these similar conditions would apply to other properties we just didn't analyze that are within our urban growth boundary. So...
But in that assessment, you hit the majority of the properties that are developable in Newport.
I tried.
You did.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, there's some infill pockets scattered around
yeah.
where we're going to run into some of these similar situations. I can think of the up on the Uquinahead area has some issues. Rocky Way, for example. Some of the property back behind, Golf Course Drive. Some of the properties along Vista. But they're all infill.
We have 2 clients right now, like both for commercial properties, but they've been looking for even like mediocre property. And it's just, you know, we've been looking for 3 years and mm-hmm. every single piece of property that you just identified, I've looked at almost every single one I've looked into detail on, and they're all incredibly challenging to develop.
So is Public Works going to take a look at this and say, oh, you know, we ought to be planning our project for this year and next year in areas 5, 6, and 8 and just ignore everything up north because it's not going to work out anyway. And to try and encourage, make those properties more attractive to developers, or is it the developers come in and say, hey, we'd love to do this, but we can't quite make it work. And then Public Works says, okay, well.
I think we're going to need to do some strategic partnerships as we have previously with developers. And we're going to want to leverage the urban renewal resources we have, the tax increment financing, particularly in the Agate Beach area, to kind of close the gap on some of these properties. For example, that one up there by Surfview Village, this big one here, we have a potential partnership with Mosaic, who's the developer. They're just kind of going slow on this one.
Look at this, it says, why bother? We can't afford it.
Well, no, 1A said you're gonna have problems with apartments, but you may be okay with a single family product. And they're looking actually at a single family product on the bulk of the acreage. So it may work there. And we also on 1A, we'll have an opportunity to talk to them about maybe getting a park site out of that somewhere, maybe a couple acres dedicated for parks, which we sorely need up in that area on the east side of 101 in exchange for some of the infrastructure contributions. So we'll be looking for those types of partnerships. Public Works was directly involved in working on the numbers. So we had reasonably good numbers based on some of the pricing we've been getting and then kind of escalated it forward. So. But the decision on how we invest infrastructure, our limited infrastructure dollars, is ultimately a policy call. So this will provide some insight as to, you know, what we should be thinking about and likely some recommendations at the end of the day in terms of, you know, what areas might be prioritized for infrastructure investment. But at the end of the day, the council's going to have to decide, you know, okay, do we go ahead and forge ahead with, you know, ABC projects as opposed to other alternatives that may be in the hopper. But I did want to show you, this. I mean, this is an example of kind of the level of detail that we gave them, you know. So we had to give them a list of extraordinary assumptions so that they could do the analysis. And so, you know, like on 1A, I had to tell them, go ahead and deduct this acreage out because they're going to do an assisted living. We're not assessing assisted living. So don't include that in your buildable acreage for 1A, because it's not going to be housing of the nature that we're analyzing. You know, include city collector looped road. This was our pricing at per lineal foot based on kind of the costs we're looking at. Other internal roads as yield streets. This was the pricing we came up for that. Assume 50% additional cost for half the length of the roads due to slope terrain. So this gets at some of the high, you know, margin of error. As I said, we have to make some assumptions. We were not in a position to go in there and calculate out exactly how much lineal feet of retaining wall is going to be required in very specific locations. We can't delve into that detail, so we have to be a little bit more rough assumption about that. So in these terrain constrained areas, having looked at, you know, some of the costs of doing this type of development in terrain constrained versus unconstrained areas, we felt 50% additional cost is reasonable in many circumstances to deal with the additional earthwork and retaining walls and things that you have to deal with when you're dealing with steeper slopes. And then in this case, you had three modular bridges at 400,000 apiece. And then behind that, I was able to provide them things like, for example, this is area 1A. We actually had a layout that they could kind of work with that was done by a prior owner of the property. So they could get a sense of how many lineal feet of internal roadway would you need to support different products. You know, so we could help them out in certain circumstances. Again, yeah, this was the conservation easement property. Just making sure they were aware that we had a conservation easement there. So we provided, and then we had, you know, concepts from that developer as to what they thought they might be able to do that they could take a look at. So we provided them background info where we could. This was the estimate for Harney Street with its breakdown that we just did as part of the transportation system plan and its street section and its alignment going through the Bridgeview property above the middle school. This was the layout that Wilder put together for the balance of their network. We were able to share that with them as well. This is the analysis that was done for the BGB property. So you have a pretty good estimate in terms of what it's going to take for that. So we had some reasonably good numbers in some areas in terms of what the infrastructure costs would be to serve those properties. But again, there's a bit of art to this as well. So any other thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I had a question about this. You sent us that link to the Oregon Housing Needs Analysis.
The statewide one?
Yeah.
That they're taking public comment on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I was yelling at my screen for about 15, 20 minutes. It was just like, hey, we're doing most of this stuff already. We may be forced to do a lot of this stuff we're doing right now. Under this regime.
Yeah.
After going through it. I just wanted to make that point that, you know, we're probably going to end up having to do this exactly what we just did.
Yes.
And make those choices and then have to justify it. That's the part that I didn't like. You're getting down to the point where the city has to justify what they're doing. It was like, I don't know, it was just rubbing me raw. So.
Yeah, you may have seen, I know the mayor did, he kicked me a note over the weekend saying, hey, do we need to think about this? And this has to do with some litigation now that's Beaverton and I believe Medford have, and others are now going to be litigating against the state on some recent rulemaking. It's the Equitable Communities climate rulemaking package. I forget the full lingo off the top of my head, but these rules apply to communities in metropolitan areas, so it doesn't apply to us. I was able to tell the mayor, hey, don't sweat it. We don't really need to dive into this because it doesn't apply to us. But it applies to these other jurisdictions, and you know they've done a lot of, in many cases, such as I think it was Hillsborough was saying, we've done a lot of planning work, and we think we've done some good work, and these statewide rules now throw out all that planning work we just did, and we're going to have to start over. And you're going to see a big fight coming up here, it looks like, between these larger jurisdictions and the state in litigation over home rule. And they're going to be, the cities are going to be arguing that the state has gone too far with its rulemaking and does not have the authority to dictate, you know, some of these changes because of the home rule status of the communities that they're trying to impose these rules on. So we'll see how that plays out. It kind of gets kind of at your point, Jim.
Yeah.
Which
the part that got me is I read down and it says, okay, this applies to anything over 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. So I look up City of Newport.
Well, yeah.
That means
right
us.
There, right there. Uh-huh.
Just barely over, but we're over.
Send some people.
But I didn't go into it in full, you know, looking at, I was just looking at the high level, mm-hmm. skimming through that thing and going, what, really?
I think there's a frustration from a number of the cities that the state in the work it's been doing recently on rulemaking hasn't really tried to be a partner with the cities and come up with solutions in partnership with the cities. And it's been more of a top-down, rule-driven, cities, you're not doing enough, and we're going to tell you what you need to do kind of approach.
Yeah.
And you know.
Sounds like Oregon has learned from California. I've lived through that for the last decade. So,
mm-hmm.
It hasn't been fun. A lot of litigation still. So,
and it's unfortunate because while litigation is helpful at times to be able to define where the boundaries are, it's also a tremendous use of resources that could be used in a more productive way.
Okay, any other comments or questions for Derek before we move on to the next one?
Well, I have a general comment on this. I'm not sure where the appropriate time is. I've been concerned about this housing assessment study for some time. Clearly, very necessary for us to look at. However, my concern goes beyond that. Not knowing how many homes we're talking, not knowing how many people we are talking, I have not seen any numbers from this city in the 15 years that I've lived here and the 30 years that I've owned property here that convinces me that this city has a water supply that can regularly meet the needs of this city. I would remind you of just a year or two ago during COVID, certainly a difficult time, but resorts were limited to 50% occupancy. That's half the tourists they normally have. They were asked to ask their customers to reduce their water use. The residents of the city were put on level 2 restrictions. Where would we have been that summer had we had all the tourists in town? There wasn't a COVID. Who knows what level of restriction? We have companies here that require huge amounts of water, fish processing, and I would imagine Rogue does too. So I've not seen this. I would have preferred to see a parallel study done by the city on our water and our water availability. It does not matter that we have a chance to do something up on Rocky Creek, up by Depot Bay, that we have the rights to do it. I bought property here in 1990, and they were already talking about the trouble with the dam here in town. We are now 32 years later. We have finally got some money, but that's only for doing some planning and some pre-engineering. That isn't shoring up the dam. It isn't protecting the dam. That will take millions more, years more, and that does not assure us of any more water. That's no more water than we have now. So if you're starting to talk 200, 500, 600 houses and the people that occupy it, we need to be thinking about water. And I think that should be something that is considered with this and the DLCD and stuff like that. You can't just put down rules when there are limited resources. And clean, drinkable water is very limited here. And I think that needs to be part of this discussion as we move forward to how many houses we really can afford. I'd like everybody to have running water in their homes. So that's my comment for the day. I'm done.
Anything else? All right, moving on to Yaquina Bay Estuary Management Plan update, needs and gap assessment.
5-10 minutes is about perfect for this. I did not intend to do a deep dive on this. I tried to be clear about that in the memo. So I provided background information as background information. And, you know, this is a process that the state started some time ago, and it's gone. They hired a consultant. They formed advisory committee and a technical advisory committee. And they struggled with figuring out how they wanted to approach updating the Yaquina Bay, Yaquina Estuary Management Plan. And I thought I had a little, there we go. I want to just bring that up just to remind folks that this is not a city-specific planning process. The Yaquina Bay Estuary, this is the map of it, goes all the way up to Toledo-ish. And so the bulk of the estuary work that they're looking at is actually outside of the city limits. Newport city limits is kind of just right in this area here. That's McLean Point right there. So our role with it is limited to this area. And that the balance of this is either unincorporated Lincoln County or the city of Toledo. But the eventually what they decided was they'd take some time to do a gap assessment, a need and gap assessment on that estuary plan. That estuary plan was done in 82. I attached a copy of it.
The telling part is typewritten.
It's typed, yep.
It looked like it, yeah.
Yep, it's old. And, you know, it's an important document because that's the policy and the technical analysis behind the rules we apply for in-water development. I mean, that's the key for us. And the in-water development, you know, may be economic development related, or in-water development could be conservation related. And we've seen both, you know. So, you know, reestablishment of eelgrass beds or cobble revetments at Hatfield to try to slow erosion, or new piers, pile, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot to it that updating that plan. And so what they did was this assessment, and I've just got the check sheet here. And so they went through the plan and they identified what things they thought they can do now, what things they thought need to be done but would have to be deferred because they don't have the resources to do it right now. So that, or tier three, which would be things that even if you deferred them, you're going to need outside support to get it done at the end of the day. So I did provide some feedback to them, and my feedback largely was in two kind of bents. One, the estuary management plan is supposed to accommodate economic development in addition to achieving conservation efforts. And my first blush look at this was a lot about conservation, and all of the economic development stuff gets deferred to tier two. And when you put that in front of policymakers, particularly folks like the Port of Newport, and they're bored, you know, that's tough. And so, you know, my advice to them was, you know, if you're going to defer some of these key economic development related elements to tier two, then you need to explain how or what you're doing in tier one. How is that promoting economic development or making it a little bit more straightforward to accomplish economic development objectives? Otherwise, it comes across a little bit too conservation heavy, in my view, on the approach. The other one was they were kicking the estuary and use standards into deferring work on the standards, but they wanted to tackle plan implementation process. If you're not going to revisit the standards, I think you have a hard time effectively reworking the process. The two go hand in hand. Standards are discretionary, that influences the process one way. Standards are clear and objective, influence it a different way. How many standards, how complex the standards are, what agencies have to speak to the standards, all of those things influence process. So kicking the standards review down the road, I think it's a tough thing to do. They, you know, their view is it's hard and it takes a lot of time, and that's why they wanted to kick it down the road. But I just think it's a hard thing to do. But, you know, if you had any comments on this or thoughts on their relative priorities, that's why I was bringing it to your attention. Also, to just make you aware of where they were at. Since the last time you had a briefing on this was from DLCD staff, I think April of last year.
Well, I'm with you. They need to do the standards first, mm-hmm. and then do your plan implementation. If you don't get those standards done, that's the hard part, and that's the part that needs to get done. Mm-hmm. I mean,
and then it informs what you want to do with the process.
Yeah. And that's kind of where you high center, because I think a lot of their standards are a little too extreme, and they've got things so narrow that nobody can do anything mm-hmm. down there. I mean, you got these narrow windows that you can work in, and you know, and I've yet to see the reasoning behind those narrow windows. What exactly would make the difference between driving a pile in winter or in summer? You know, does it stir up more mud in the winter, or does it do something different in the winter? Or
all of that is important. They haven't figured out. They talked about taking the dams out of the Columbia River, and yet they're not a time in the year they can take them out that the salmon won't be negatively impacted. The smolts, or the fry, or the adults, and so they're trying to figure out. Well, we need to take some out. We can take some out, but how do you do it without injuring the system?
Well, that goes back to the standards.
It does.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's the same thing. That's
we relive the problem many times. We never get to a solution.
What about my PED bill?
I think the other thing too is taking the opportunity to work through the standards to better define the role of local government versus the resource agencies in the review of development in water areas. We're not a resource agency, and a number of the standards as they are now ask us to serve in that capacity, which puts us in an awkward position because I'm not a biologist. is that the local government's role when you have, you know, the Department of State Land staff and State Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and National Marines? Fishery, you got all of those experts looking at this stuff. You got Army Corps looking at it. I mean, so get the roles defined right. What do we really need to look at relative to these resource agencies or you know, agencies that are responsible for the ownership of those in-water areas? So everybody has different roles. Can we clean those up a bit so that we're not overlapping them and causing confusion?
Well, I look at this as a biologist because that's my training, and they're talking about all the eelgrass, mm-hmm. and yet is anybody studying those areas? Unit 8, mm-hmm. Unit 7, Unit 6. What kind of measurements are we taking? Mm-hmm. Is this ongoing? Is it yearly? I didn't know, and so in fact, I called ODFW because I have some good friends that work there in mm-hmm. in mitigation, which is a lot of what this talks about too. And I never saw ODFW, a resource people, mm-hmm. you know, that deal with this resource of ours all year. And I never saw them mentioned in here. Mm-hmm. I saw NOAA, you know, I saw NASA, you know, but I didn't see ODFW. But I contacted them and they said, no, we do have a rep. We do have a rep on it. And there's some good people here. But there's no way to monitor whether or not these management plans work, because we don't go out and mm-hmm. judge what's happened to the eelgrass, what's happened to the shellfish nesting area. Yeah. So we don't go out and test it. We just mm-hmm. discover it, that's what's there, and we walk away. So a lot of monitoring, a lot of measuring isn't even in this plan. And I don't know how they expect to manage a water resource as important as this without any constant monitoring. No parameters are listed. So I know I don't understand the project. I do know that.
Any other comments? Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
And then I guess the last thing on the planning list was update the work
calendar.
Update.
Yeah, calendar.
Yes. Yeah, I made a few changes. Yes. I do want to let you know, after I put this out, I got a email from the developer that's looking to do that development up on Yaquinahead, and they decided to withdraw their subdivision application. So Starfish Cove definitely will not happen on October 10th. They just said market conditions are such they can't proceed with the project.
This is the one on the north side?
North side of Yaquinahead, about 23 lots.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's going on next to the restaurant? That's not what we're talking about.
No. That will likely be a small number of multifamily units. How many, I don't know right
next
now.
Next to the old former Izzy's?
Yeah.
It's owned by the same individual that owns the restaurant.
Max,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
It's his project.
It's his workforce housing, is it?
Where exactly, Derek, is that Starfish Cove?
Would it have been?
Would it have been, yes.
On the north side of Yaquinahead.
55th?
Yes.
Well, Biggs, you don't have Biggs there right now. You just have a right-of-way for it. But that would have, and then it was sandwiched between Biggs and Rhododendron. Rhododendron does stub a little bit. Biggs really doesn't do much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would have been up on the slope there right next to the Smith Tank. Just downslope of the Smith Tank.
East of the big mansions.
On that undeveloped area that many people think of probably as part of the Yaquinahead Natural Area.
They do.
But it is not.
I want some monitoring gun.
But, you know, it's steeply sloped, and I think they just, at the end of the day, couldn't make it pencil out given market conditions, especially with, you know, interest rates climbing as they are right now from historic lows, but climbing nonetheless.
Sure. Yeah. Good for them to know when to back out.
Mm-hmm. So that won't happen.
Because of rising interest rates
development costs have been escalating pretty fast. I mean, there are a number of factors that they were probably considering.
Inflation and all of that's torpedoed the project.
And they probably, as they were continuing to delve into the engineering in greater detail, those costs kept going up in terms of, what's it going to take. Some of the lots on that, if they were to proceed, would have been above the elevation we can provide adequate water pressure too, so you're then having to factor in water pump systems on the individual lots to get the kind of water pressure you need. And so they were having to get into those details. So I do expect the annexation proposal to come in pretty soon. So that one, I do expect to land on the October 24th would be about where we would land at for potential church use. And I do expect the Boston Timber will be coming back to us here within a few months. It's in the county. That's that land swap. It's been stuck with the county for over a year now. They're not on a legal. That's one of the things that these urban growth boundary swaps don't mandate local jurisdictions take action in a specific period of time. And they've been high-centered with the county for a long time because the county has no resources and what resources they have, they've been applying to other things that they are on a clock to address. And so it's languished. But it's not going to look the same as it did the last time you saw it. It'll be about 3.5 acres smaller in terms of the swap. You'll see kind of what that looks like.
Derek, looking at October 10,
mm-hmm.
Why is this commission considering the land use consequence of the camping ordinance after the council's already heard it on October 3? Is that the cart before the horse?
No, because what the council's looking at is not land use related. It's non-land use related camping provisions, so stuff within the public right-of-way largely. This is to kind of match up. You have a chance to take a look at the private side regulations. For example, we had one of our city councilors, it was Dietmar, was asking about, well, what are the rules relative to how many people can stay in tents on somebody's property? That's not what they're looking at right now in terms of the public rights of way, but that would fall under your purview. And I can kind of walk through what the current regulatory framework is for that. Similarly, as many of you know, with RVs on private property, you cannot connect them to your wastewater system. They cannot be resided in
right.
When parked in your driveway.
That's right.
That's a land use piece.
Okay.
Right now, what the council is dealing with is resting within public rights of way. So if somebody who is home.
RVs on Highway 20 between here and Toledo?
Well, in the city limits, and we have to deal with abandoned RVs in the city limits too, but that's part of it, or people just popping a tent somewhere on the city hall lawn, or
parking their car in front of city hall,
or parking their car in front of city hall, or popping up a tent, you know, right next to, we had some set up there right next to Head Start there for a few days, you know, with the Head Start building. I mean, how can we, within the sidebars set by recent court decisions in the Ninth Circuit, reasonably regulate resting or camping within public rights of way? That's what the council's dealing with right now, and that's what they will likely act upon on October 3rd. But we should double back and make sure, okay, how's that sync with the private side regulations that you're responsible for? And there are also some cross-references that we'll need to clean up as part of that, too.
Okay. Well, that reminds me of the person that addressed us at the last Planning Commission meeting about Geno's and the, the having less shit. Than, right. And I was walking through there, and my God, he's right. I'm just curious if that got turned into enforcement or anything.
Yeah, it has. We'll see where that's going. I know that's the city manager and the police department through their code enforcement are dealing with that.
Well, the guy must be happy that, you know, something happened. I hope he's happy.
I have another question.
Move a sign or you move a table. One or the other.
There's that parking lot across the street from the, La Roca restaurant, Hubert's going down?
Ninth and Herbert, yeah.
Ninth and Herbert, okay. It's empty. There's no RVs there this week. Mm-hmm. And all summer long, there seemed to be kind of a small encampment at the lower end.
Mm-hmm.
That's a permissible parking lot for camping.
That's the one that was set up for car camping under a special events permit. The council's looking at moving that to an actively managed car camping arrangement where Grace Winds would serve as the city's agent through a contract. But that's not all fully resolved yet. They're still working through the details.
I saw some of those RVs parked along the bayfront.
A lot of folks in that circumstance are moving their vehicles around. And the code enforcement with the police department's chasing them and addressing it on a case-by-case basis. But
it'll keep Officer Gabarino busy.
Can I back up to the September 26th meeting, Derek?
Yes.
And it says identify candidates for the City Center Revitalization Project Stakeholder Advisor. That's the TGM funding.
Right. So that's going to be going through an RFP through the state to get a consultant on board. But I thought we ought to jump on getting at least the stakeholder groups identified, because we'll need to have that pretty early in the process. So start to work through, okay.
So these will be local people who are the stakeholders that you're talking, or are these?
It's probably going to be a mix of there'll be local people, correct?
Yeah.
And then there may be some other, you know, entities like the county and the school district and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago when we were going through that, there was a listing of possible stakeholders. And
so we'll want to take a look at that. That's what that's about.
Are people asked to volunteer? Is that something that will go with that advisory committee or as a list of stakeholders? Will there be people who want to volunteer for that? They see themselves as a stakeholder.
Yeah, there may very well be a recruitment period once we kind of identify kind of what the framework looks like to get that filled out. And then there will be groups we're going to want to reach out to, too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on the work session?
That's all I had.
No, then we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, I'm